Yes, as we're proceeding along, we get to the parsha this week, which of course has the Ten Commandments. And it's interesting that in the rabbinic tradition, there's kind of an ambivalence as to how you look at the Ten Commandments. You know, I'm sure you've heard many Jews say over the years that, you know, well, I don't keep everything, but I keep the Ten Commandments. And everybody considers the Ten Commandments to be the foundation of the whole Torah. In fact, even in the legal system, you know, in the secular legal system of the United States, you know, many courtrooms, in fact, this has gone to the Supreme Court, many courtrooms have displays of the Ten Commandments as kind of the foundation of justice, and people have brought lawsuits claiming that it's, of course, often they're Jews, claiming that it's a violation of the separation of church and state to have the Ten Commandments, you know, in a courtroom or whatever it is, like a Christmas tree or a Hanukkah menorah or whatever. But here is the thing. On one hand, the Ten Commandments are very unique because it's the only part of the Torah where God revealed himself to all of Israel. Every other part of the Torah, we heard it from Moshe secondhand, although Moshe was, of course, God's designated prophet. The Ten Commandments we actually heard directly from God, although we'll see there's some confusion about that as well. On the other hand, let me share with you a passage in the Talmud. The Talmud says that there used to be a custom in the temple that they would read the Ten Commandments every single day. And the rabbis discontinued the custom because too many people were saying that the only important part of the Torah is the Ten Commandments. And the rabbis didn't want people to think it's only the Ten Commandments that are important. And as a result, they actually said not to read it, at least publicly, not to read it every day. That's very interesting. In other words, they didn't want the attitude that only the Ten Commandments count. Now, because of that, by the way, some people have questioned a very widespread common practice. You know, when we're going to read the Torah this coming Shabbos, when we reach the Ten Commandments, everybody stands up. So, and that's almost a universal custom. Everybody stands up for the Ten Commandments. No less a figure than Maimonides himself questioned that custom, because by standing up for the Ten Commandments, you're implying that the rest of the Torah didn't come from God. So his position was to sit during the Ten Commandments. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein defends the prevailing custom by pointing out that we do stand up a few verses before and a few verses after. So we do kind of encompass the rest of the Torah. And we also stand up for other parts of the Torah. For example, last week we stood up for Oz Yashir. Of course, the custom of yeshivos is we stand up for all of Torah reading. Although I'm not telling you to do that, but you know, according to that custom, you don't have any... Obviously, you don't have any problem there, but even those who sit, you know, will stand up for the Ten Commandments. Okay. So that's one thing. So on one hand, the Ten Commandments is special because we heard it from God as opposed to hearing it from Moshe. On the other hand, it's not special because all of the Torah comes from God, even if we heard it from Moshe, right? So everything is ultimately going to be divine. The other thing that you need to point out, which is pretty obvious, is that the Hebrew phrase for the Ten Commandments does not mean Ten Commandments. What is the phrase? Aseres Hadibros. Now, Dibros does not mean commandment. That would be Aseres HaMitzvos. Dibros means 10 statements, 10 utterances. And in fact, if you read the Ten Commandments, you will see, I'll say commandments because that's how we call it, there's actually 13 or 14 commandments in the Ten Commandments. In terms of some of the general categories have more than one commandment in them, although we'll have to define what that is.
Even if it's from on here, one...
So that's a big argument among the commentary, just how to understand things. If you read the Chumash, if you just read the Chumash plain, the impression you certainly get is they heard all ten. They heard all ten. However, Rashi brings a number of Midrashim and Gemaras that actually say what happened was that God started giving us the commandments. We heard the first two. I am the Lord your God, and thou shalt not have any other gods. We were then so frightened that we begged Moshe to go to God and ask God to give him the stuff and give it to us. So according to that interpretation, we only heard the first two, but we were nevertheless present in the sound and light extravaganza, as Rabbi Geffen would say, when God was giving Moshe the rest. So in a sense, all ten we did experience as a divine revelation, although we only heard two. Now, this is based on a Gemara in Maseches Makos, and the Gemara is a fascinating little proof for that. And that is, we know our tradition is there are 613 commandments. But we know there's a verse that says, Torah Siva Lanu Moshe. Moshe gave us Torah. Now take the letters of Torah. Tuf, Vav, Resh, He. And you know, every letter in Hebrew has a numerical value called gematria. So Tuf, Vav, Resh, He is 611. So the Gemara asks, how can I say Moshe gave us 611 if there are 613? Answer, 611 we got from Moshe, but 2 we got from God. And that's how you get 613. So that is indeed the Talmudic interpretation. Although Maimonides, in the Guide to the Perplexed, takes a different view. Maimonides actually says, we heard nothing from God at all. Moshe heard everything. And that which the Talmud says, we got the first two commandments from God, he learns very allegorically, and that is, by seeing God's revelation, we understood intuitively that there's a God. So it's not that we heard any words from God, but rather the message that I am the God who took you out of Egypt, and I am the God that there's no other God, we heard in the sense that we saw and we experienced, and that was equivalent to hearing it directly from God. Yeah.
But in the world accustomed to polytheism,
You know, that's a good question. It's a little hard for us to understand exactly. What could God show us that would negate the existence of other gods, right? That, as you're saying, you know, a polytheist could believe in
that act, I'm saying, not necessarily. Of course, they
might. No, I understand. In other words, yeah. But apparently what happened at Matan Torah is a process that really cannot be described in purely human visual terms, and that is, it was perceived how God is the source of all life and all being in the universe. In other words, essentially, by perceiving the channel of creation, and the energy of creation, and the cosmic structures of the universe, it was understood that God is the single source of all. Now, again, I don't know what you see that makes you understand that, but apparently it was that. And again, I want to point out, I know Rabbi Gottlieb is away, so I'm not sure if you heard his lectures on it or not, but Rav Yehuda Halevi, you've heard of, he was a great philosopher and poet who lived in Spain, before Maimonides. He was a long time ago. He was in the 11th century, and he wrote one of the famous classics of Jewish philosophy. Although it's funny, it's all called Jewish philosophy. Actually, it's an anti-philosophical book, but his book is called The Kuzari. And the way he wrote it had a very interesting structure. It was based on an actual story, which he then appropriated to expound his philosophy. And that is, there was a group of people in Russia, around the Caspian Sea, they were called the Khazars. And in the Middle Ages, the Khazars somehow converted to Judaism it was kind of a forced conversion. The king converted to Judaism and he forced everyone else to convert. So whether they were halakhically Jewish is an interesting question. But the king is said to have had dreams from God or from an angel of God telling the king that your intentions are good, but your deeds are wanting. And as a result, the king embarked on an exploration of different religions, and he was convinced that Judaism was correct. But it was a very warlike people. It wasn't like passive, gentle people sitting in a base medrash. These actually were mercenaries and soldiers, and the king kind of forced the whole nation to become Jewish. But in the Middle Ages, and this was a true story, there actually was such a nation. They're largely extinct, although, digression, there is a controversial theory out there that the majority of Ashkenazic Jewry is actually descended from the Khazars. There actually is such a theory that we are descended from the Khazars. That was Arthur Koestler. There, some have said that's a bunch of junk, and some have given it some validity and the like. But be it as it may, in the Middle Ages, this was something that very much excited the imaginations of Jews, because Jews in the Middle Ages were so oppressed, whether it's the Crusades or Islamic persecutions, to have a whole powerful nation want to be Jewish. It was something that really, you know, excited people's curiosity. So Rav Yehuda Halevi did was he appropriated the story, And he wrote a book which purports to reconstruct the dialogues between the king and a rabbi. Now, it's all made up. Rita Levi made this up. There was no record of the actual discussions. But Rita Levi uses the imaginary reconstruction of the dialogue between the king and the chaver. Chaver means the scholar, the rabbi, to expound on the fundamental principles of Judaism. And this is the sefer called the Kuzari, which means the dialogue with the Kuzar, with the Khazars. Now, in that book, Rav Yehuda Halevi makes the assertion, via his rabbi, of course, that the strongest proof of the validity of Judaism is the fact of mass revelation itself. And this is called the Kuzari principle. Again, Rabbi Gottlieb has many, many lectures on this, and I'm not going to present it in all of its richness and complexity. But essentially, his argument is that Judaism is the only religion that has ever claimed mass revelation. So his argument goes the following. If I were to tell you that God appeared to me and made me a prophet, if you trust me, if you like me, if you feel that I'm an honest person, I might be able to convince you. And eventually, I could have quite a lot of followers who believe that God appeared to me. Now, the fact that I might have even millions of followers is no ultimate proof of veracity, because it rests ultimately on kind of an unverifiable claim that God appeared to me, that God accepted. But if we make the claim that God didn't just appear to Moses, but God appeared to 3 million people, because that's our typical estimate, that there were 600,000 plus Jews who left Egypt from the age of 20. So if you, those are men. So if you factor in women and people below 20, you know, the normal estimate is 3 million people. So Judaism claims not that God appeared to Moses, but that God appeared to 3 million people. Now the question is, if that happens on Monday morning, how do you convince people Tuesday morning? Meaning, I can convince you that God appeared to me, but how do I convince you that God appeared to you? And if you're gullible, how does that work for 3 million people? So the Kuzari's argument is that the very audaciousness of the claim of mass revelation, which was believed, certainly, by the Jewish people, itself is indicative of truth, because it's a non-falsifiable type of assertion. Now, you might argue, well, who says it's true? In other words, you're telling me, there's the Kuzari argues that if people, since you couldn't make it a lot, you couldn't fool people, so if it's believed, it must be true. Well, the argument is, well, most Jews today don't believe it. But here is the point. Even if you take, let's say, a Reform perception and you say this never happened, you cannot deny the historical reality that up to a few hundred years ago, most Jews did believe that it happened. Meaning, even if you say it didn't happen, historically, Jews believed that it happened. And the question becomes, how do you create a mass psychosis to that degree? Again, we could argue, is that a totally waterproof argument or not? But this is the famous Kuzari argument, in which he says the historical claim of mass revelation is a fundamental proof to its veracity, because such an assertion could not have been implanted in the midst of large numbers of people. Okay. Again, Rabbi Gottlieb will address that in much more detail, but this is the Kuzari. And that's why I mentioned before that the Kuzari, although it's classified as a book of Jewish philosophy, actually has a very anti-philosophical orientation, because his fundamental idea is that the tenets of Judaism are verified by history and not by philosophy. In other words, unlike Maimonides, who attempted to provide a rational syllogistic approach to the tenets of faith, the Kuzari was very suspicious of philosophy, and the Kuzari preferred to look at history. And indeed, if you go to different presentations, the idea that the Jewish people surviving, kind of the miracles of Jewish survival, just looking at history as proof, all of that is actually based on Kuzari foundations, kind of the notion of history as the unfolding of God's will, and as being a more secure and a more solid basis than any type of particularly syllogistic Aristotelian type of argument. Of course, it's no accident that Maimonides never quotes Rav Yehuda HaLevi. You can imagine Maimonides didn't like that whole approach. And as a result, although he was familiar with the Kuzari, there's not a single place in Maimonides' writings where he makes any reference to it. He kind of just ignores.
How do we know he was familiar with it then?
Well, number one, it was very well known. And number two, I think in his letters he makes some derogatory references to it.
Okay, but just not
in his publications, not. But again, I think this shows you, we sometimes like to kind of classify all Jewish works like, everybody, learned all Jewish works and they're all holy and sacred, which they are. But you have to understand that there are different approaches here. Maimonides' approach was very different than Rav Yehuda HaLevi's approach. And Maimonides, in fact, did not like that particular analysis. But still, Rav Yehuda HaLevi did very much rely on history and the improbability of falsification of mass hysteria. Yeah.
So you're saying his was anti-logic.
Well, I won't say anti-logic, but he was anti. Some of the Kuzri was somewhat anti-philosophy. That's
right.
Correct.
Logic and epistemology is a sub-discipline of philosophy, and I mean.
No, I understand. I mean, listen. First of all, in the Middle Ages, everything was philosophy. Philosophy means love of wisdom. I mean, science was called natural philosophy. So I'm using philosophy as we apply it today, but certainly the Kuzari was not against philosophy because he would say inferences from history would be a form of philosophy. What I mean, though, is he was against Maimonides in The Guide to the Perplexed, approaches things like the existence of God by a series of propositions. He tries to create Aristotelian syllogisms, and Maimonides, of course, was a great admirer of Aristotle, to try to prove certain things, like almost in geometrical precision. The Kuzari had a certain disdain for it, maybe because he was a poetic temperament, after all. And the Kuzari also felt that philosophy, that type of formalistic, syllogistic reasoning, could lead a person up blind alleys in many cases. You have to be alive to the historical realities of life and kind of learn from life instead of kind of the more academic
theoretical. It's the same format. If you tell a large group of people that they witnessed an event and they did not, then the only possible.
Obviously he's using logic. Yeah, well, he's using logic. I won't say the Kuzari is anti-logic. That would be overstating it.
You've seen that. I mean, even just looking at the U.S., you see that people accept false histories. I mean, like.
Well, that's
right now and see how many people think we're like great, great today.
Well, this is what Hitler called. Hitler called the big lie, part of what not the way the Nazi propaganda machine was able to get so much power in Germany itself was by convincing large numbers of people of certain facts, either about the Jews, about the economy, about the world, about the Versailles Treaty, about the German power. That's very true. However, I think the Kuzari would argue that convincing you about political and social phenomena is very different than convincing you about a claim that you saw something firsthand. And mass revelation is not simply, trying to convince you that the Treaty of Versailles was, morally corrupt. I'm trying to convince you that you saw, fire and lightning yesterday. And that's a different type of thing. That's a specific visual and spiritual phenomena that, a person is not going to be amenable to believe.
I don't think anybody disagrees with that. I think the disagreement comes, like you said, if this happened on a Monday, didn't happen on Monday, you can't convince somebody it did on Tuesday.
Right.
I think the point of disagreement comes up in, I don't think anybody's making the assertion that it happened like that. People are saying later on at a point is when a false history could have been kind of injected into the public consciousness.
But the question is, the question basically is this. The question is that, even if you take the position, like, Reform or a secular Jew, that it didn't happen, right? But we can certainly trace belief in that phenomena, really 2,000 years. In other words, going back to Talmud, Medrash. In other words, I'm not asserting that, I'm not proving something is true because in the Talmud it says it's true. I'm not making that point. But I'm making the point is that the belief did persist fairly close to the alleged date of the event. And the question becomes, you know, that type of falsification would not have been easy. You know, that's again, as I say, there's a lot of ins and outs on this argument, but this is the essential thrust of the Kuzari. Again, as an aside, I mean, I'm not giving a shiur in Kuzari, but as an aside, I'll just mention another thing that made the Kuzari a very beloved work in Hasidic circles much later, is that the Kuzari does assert. This could be controversial, the inherent holiness and uniqueness of the Jewish soul. And that's something Maimonides does not actually do. It's very, very interesting. Maimonides...
Is that to assume that non-Jews also have a soul, but are not necessarily...
That's correct. The same way? But the way the Kuzari says it is, the Kuzari says it this way. He says, we know that in classical divisions of existence, there is the inanimate... And then there is the vegetative, and then there is the animal, right? So the inanimate, the rocks and the minerals, the vegetative, again, this is from Aristotle's classification, which is plants and vegetables. And then there is the animal soul, which is animals. And then there is the human soul, and that's called the speaker. Speech was considered to be evidence of the divine quality of the soul. And the concept, therefore, is that in classical Jewish philosophy, it's understood that the human is not just an animal, but the human has a godly soul. And therefore, the human is fundamentally a different species, so to speak, than animals. I mean, species meaning a whole different level of life. By the way, that's challenged today by some environmental extremists. So there are some environmental extremists who actually feel that any type of behavior that prefers humans over any other life is a form of speciesism. Peter Singer, for example, who's a very brilliant person, Jewish person, has really taken the position that humans have no bigger claim to anything on earth than animals and the like. And that's actually PETA's philosophy as well. Now, Judaism, of course, requires that we treat animals with compassion. Judaism is very much against animal cruelty, and Judaism would condemn animal experimentation for cosmetics or vanities or the like, as opposed to cancer medication. But nevertheless, Judaism looks at it as a matter of responsibility of the higher to the lower rather than equality. We would absolutely reject any type of morality that would equate people and animals. Rather, it's precisely because of the higher status of the human that there is responsibility towards the lower. But the recognition must be of the higher to the lower. Now, here's the thing. All of that is relatively non-controversial. The Kuzari posits, however, that the Jewish soul is a qualitatively different entity than the non-Jewish soul. And the same way, human to animal is Jew to rest of humanity. Now, on one level...
It's almost like reverse racism.
Well, it's racism, but once again, but it carries responsibility. That's the difference. So the chosenness, the idea of the chosen people is a responsibility to humanity, not an excuse to disparage. Now, it's interesting that in Maimonides' writings, again, I'm not just here to give you two perspectives. Maimonides almost never focuses on the uniqueness of the Jewish soul. In Maimonides' hierarchy, you are what you do. Meaning, if you're virtuous, righteous, and holy, you have elevated yourself over the rest of humanity. But if you're not virtuous, righteous, and holy, the fact that you're Jewish doesn't mean anything in particular. Now, this Maimonides looks at everything based on what did you do? How do you live? Rav Yehuda Halevi introduces the concept of what you might call innateness, that no matter what you do, no matter what you are, you have that holiness indelibly stamped in you. Now, I want to point out that the Hasidic movement, again, 600 years later, the Hasidic movement enthusiastically embraced that idea. You may have heard the expression in Yiddish, the pintalayid, that in every Jew there is this torch of holiness that is burning, and that's essentially, okay, it's a updating, so to speak, of the Kuzari's idea of the inherent holiness of the Jewish soul. As I say, Maimonides often did not talk in those terms. Maimonides basically says, you know, you live a good life, you're righteous. You don't live a good life, you're not righteous. You know, there's no notion of inherent, you know, you're inherently good because you're a certain person. So as a result, those who are negative about this philosophy call the Kuzari racist. That's not Chas Shalom. I'm just quoting what people say. On the other hand, as I say, it's become very, very accepted. But again, I do want to emphasize that any discussion, and this is very, very important, any discussion about the innate holiness of the Jew should never be disparaging anyone. I mean, the Chazal do teach us that the righteous Gentiles have a share of the world to come. And it's also important to know that the famous verse in Genesis that man was made in the image of God clearly applies to non-Jews as well as Jews. And I'll prove this to you from Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avos. In Pirkei Avos, the great Rabbi Akiva makes two statements. And listen to the order of the statements. Statement number one is, beloved is mankind because they were created in the image of God. Statement number two is, beloved is Israel, for they are the children of the Almighty. Now, it's clear that when he says beloved is man because he's created in the image of God, he doesn't mean Jews, because that's exactly the second statement. Right? So Rabbi Akiva is teaching us an important thing in the first statement as well, that every single human being is made in the image of God. Jews have a special thing. We're like God's children, so to speak. So it's kind of everyone's the image of God, and then we have the father-child. relationship. So that's why, I'm sure you've heard this many times. I mean, so whatever the concept of chosenness means, it is never a basis to disparage. It's never a basis to denigrate. Racism and making fun and belittling any type of human being is something that's totally against the way of God and the way of Judaism, the way of Torah. If there is chosenness, if there is innateness, it manifests itself in responsibility and in trying to live up to a higher standard. And in many ways, you know, anti-Semites are right. You know, when anti-Semites, you know, accuse Jews of doing this and that and that and that, and our response might be, well, they do a lot worse. You know, we're certainly no worse than a lot that's going on out there. Well, but the answer might be, but that's not for us. That for us, that's not a defense. In other words, in fact, God expects that we try to live to a higher standard. Meaning, the fact that we're no worse than people who are living at a lower standard is, in reality, not. Maybe it's not fair for them to accuse us, but in reality, for our own internal introspection, it's something to think about. You know, in terms of what the responsibility of being a Jew in the world is. Yeah.
Could Rav Yehuda Levi's statement about the Jewish soul innately being on a higher level,
right,
was that a statement that it was innate or an innate fact, or do you think it could have been or can be interpreted as an observation that perhaps the Jewish nation as a whole has maintained a higher level of spirituality, and therefore that is why on a higher state?
Well, it seems to be a fundamental fact. In other words, perhaps he infers it from an observation, but he's not simply saying they maintain it. He's saying there's an innate quality. And Rav Yehuda Levi also, another great thing is Rav Yehuda Levi very much articulates the idea that the optimal functioning of the Jewish soul is only in the land of Israel. So there are a number of themes in the Kuzari that get emphasized that Maimonides kind of de-emphasizes. Kuzari, uniqueness of Jewish people. Kuzari, need to be connected to the land. Maimonides is more of a universalist in a number of ways. In fact, it's interesting that he puts into the king's mouth, and of course Rav Yehuda Levi supplied both sides of the dialogue here. Rav Yehuda Levi puts into the king's mouth a good question. He says, I don't understand you Jews. You pray three times a day to be able to return to the land of Israel. And you're able to come. Why don't you come? And Rav Yehuda Levi has the rabbi answer, Your Majesty, this is our shame. This is our embarrassment. that we pray for something over and over again, and we are like the twittering, this is before there was Twitter, we are like the twittering of birds who simply twitter away and don't even mean what we're saying. And he bemoaned it. Now keep in mind, at the time when he wrote, this is the 11th century, at that time, depending on the year exactly, Israel, or you know, the Eretz Yisrael, was largely occupied by the various Crusader kingdoms. This was the aftermath of the First Crusade. And living for a Jew to live here was quite a difficult hardship. And even then, Rav Yehuda Halevi says, why don't more Jews come to the land of Israel? Today, you know, the major hardship is a 12-hour plane ride, which is rough, you know, so to speak. That's roughing it, El Al, you know,
no,
coach.
10.
Huh?
12 on the way back.
You're right. It's, yeah, 10 hours to Israel, 12. I'm thinking of my trip to America, which is 12 hours, right. 12 to America, 10 back. That's right. That's right. So you got El Al, and then, you know, it's hard to get Haagen-Dazs here, although you can get Ben and Jerry's, you know, so we have hardships and suffering and the like, but, you know, come on, you know, not like, well, there actually is, there's some, you know, in yeshiva, you know, we have all these restrictions, but, you know, go out in the street, you know, as I say, you know, you got to suffer for Israel, you know,
that we lost
$15. Yeah, okay, listen, there are hardships, so to speak. But they're nothing, you know. You wouldn't want to be back in the 11th century and living here. And in fact, you wouldn't even want to be here in the 1920s. You know, I read the autobiography of Golda Meir. And Golda Meir was hardly a religious Jew at all, in many ways. But Golda Meir writes about, you know, she was in Milwaukee. She came from the Ukraine and grew up in Milwaukee as a teenager. And then she comes to Israel as a Zionist. She comes to Israel as a Zionist, and you know she talks about, you know, draining the swamps and sleeping outside in the mud. You know, just unbelievable. You know, the hardships that generation went through to build this country. And you know, you have to admire that. You know, even though they were not keeping the commandments, and that's a sad thing, but there was something in them that. You know, and Rav Kook would say that is also from God, that they wanted to build up this holy land. So Rav Yehuda Halevi very much talks about the uniqueness of the land of Israel. He makes the point, I think I mentioned a few days ago about Hallel, that prophecy can only happen in the land of Israel because of the special holiness here. Now, legend has it, just to finish my little digression here, that he actually left Spain to come to the land of Israel, even though he was wealthy and successful in Spain. This is the golden age of Spain, at the beginning of the golden age of Spain, which ended in 1492 with the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. But for 400 years, there was a golden period where Jews were very prosperous, successful. There was a flourishing of art and science and Torah learning among the Jews of Spain. But the legend has it, he got to the gates of Jerusalem, and at the very gates of Jerusalem, an Arab horseman rode by and pierced him with a spear. And legend has it that he died at the gates of Yerushalayim. I'm not sure if it's 100% true, but the story goes he died at the gates of Yerushalayim, never entering the city. So he tried to live up to the principles that he espoused. And as they say, he's a very beloved poet and philosopher, anti-philosopher, however you want to describe it. So it's, you know, kind of worth your while if you ever get a hold of a Kuzari to look through it and see the types of things he talks about. He also, again, I'm just talking about Kuzari just as a digression, but he also, I don't even know how I got into Kuzari. Oh, by the Kuzari proof of Matan Torah as its own self-sustaining evidence. He also has the first halachic discussion in the middle of the Kuzari about the idea of the equivalent of the international dateline. It's very, very interesting because already then people were pondering the fact that if the world is a sphere, right? So when you go east, right, you have different time zones, but eventually east and west hit each other. Right? When I go west, time gets earlier, 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 earlier. When I go east, time gets later, 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 because sunrise has already happened. But at some point, east meets west. And at that point, there has to be exactly a 24-hour division. So something that's 6 a.m. Wednesday on one side will be 6 a.m. Tuesday on the other side, right? Or, you know, whatever, vice versa. And that has implications, of course, for Shabbos and Yom Tov. And the Kuzari discusses, where's the date line? Because the truth of the matter is, you know, the 180 degrees from Greenwich is just a made-up thing. In other words, you have to have a date line, but there's no logical place where you put it. And the Kuzari discusses all the way back in the 1100s, the 12th century, I'm sorry, the 11th century, the 1000s, where would halacha say that the dateline begins? In other words, where does the day begin and when is it the old day, so to speak? And exactly what he meant, it's a little hard to figure out. It's still a matter of dispute, and to this very day, there are halachic problems of when you keep Shabbos, when you're in Japan, when you're in Australia, New Zealand, and the like. These are real, real problems. You have to discuss with the rabbi as to...
Like Alaska, yeah. Where the sun doesn't set.
The Kuzari doesn't talk about that. That's actually a different problem. One is the problem of latitude, and one is the problem of longitude. The dateline problem is an east-west problem,
right.
And that's what day it is. Now, your problem is another problem. That is, the further north you go, you can have prolonged periods of night or prolonged periods of day. How do you measure Shabbos in Alaska, the Arctic Circle? Arctic Circle is even more problematical because then you got 6 months. You know, 6 months of, you know.
Not even that, but dominating.
Dominating every day. You're correct. Yeah, yeah. That's also a very, very difficult. That's also a very, very difficult issue. And there are many, many problems. You know, that's the old joke they say about, you know, what did the Jewish astronaut do during his space mission? Answer: Shacharis Minchamarev. You know. He just davened three times a day for the entire trip because, you know, right after Shacharis, time for Mincha, whatever, you know, whatever it is. But those are two separate questions, right? One is the north-south issue, one is the east-west issue. The Kuzari does not discuss the issues of north-south, but he does discuss the concept of the date line. And he even brings up, although he rejects, a very, very amazing solution, which actually has a lot of logic, but it would make life totally unworkable. And he says, think about this, and no one ever, you know, we don't even imagine this as a possibility, but it is a theoretical possibility, that maybe Shabbos ought to be observed throughout the world when it is observed in Jerusalem. When it's Shabbos in Jerusalem, it is Shabbos throughout the world. Now think what that would mean. That would mean, forget about time zones, right? So, for example, let's say Shabbos begins here in Jerusalem, let's say around 5 o'clock, 5 p.m. Okay? So what time is it in America? So in America, it's 10 a.m. Friday afternoon. So you'll keep Shabbos from 10 a.m. Friday afternoon to whatever, for 24 hours till whatever
Sunday
it
morning.
Is, you know, Sunday morning. Because there is an argument that forget about time zones. You know, the holiness of Shabbos hits the world at the same time. Now, the Kuzari toys with that idea, but he rejects it. Ultimately, he says, we got to go with our sun rising and our sun setting. We don't kind of just look at it one time. But theologically, it's a strange idea, though. Because, you know, you talk about God's presence coming to the world on Shabbos, a special presence. But essentially, what you're now saying is, it hits the world at different times. Right, that's the idea. That Shabbos hits Israel 7 hours before it hits America, then it hits America, then it, you know, hits California. You know.
Exactly, because California is 10 hours behind.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
So then it would be 7 in the morning for California.
That's correct. Yeah, I was using my New York centric mentality, but you're correct. But the Kuzari at least toys with the theoretical idea that maybe we ought to ignore time zones totally. And whenever it's Shabbos in Israel is when the divine presence, you know, comes into the world. Okay, so those are kind of some things that the Kuzari talks about. Again, I don't know how I got onto it, but it's a very, very interesting book. But as I say, Maimonides himself had some issues with it. Okay, and as I say, you know, certainly if you're Ashkenazic, and there's that old theory that all Ashkenazic Jews are related to the Khazars. Of course, that has always bothered me for a very simple reason. I think historically, it's not at all clear that the Khazars had halakhically valid conversions. I think there's a strong indicator that this kind of militant king just forced people to convert under pain of death. If that would be so, don't quote me on this, if that would be so, that would mean that if we are descended from the Khazars, perhaps our own halachic Jewishness would be thrown into question. So I would prefer to think that we don't have that problem, right? So that might be a reason not to go with that particular theory. Okay, we'll see you tomorrow. Take care.